speakers are Carl Sandburg, professor of French and Humanities at McAllister College, and his respondent Douglas Tober, professor of History at BYU. Carl Sandburg will have half an hour to speak. Douglas Tobler will have 15 minutes to speak. Afterward, we'll have 15 minutes for questions for the audience. And Carl?
Several years ago, I submitted a three-page poem to Dialogue, and after a number of weeks, it came back, and page two was on the front, page one was next, and page three was at the end, and the editorial appraisal was, the progression in this poem is not clear. I sent a copy of the paper to Doug Tobler by fax, and he showed me the copy that came through, and it was badly garbled. And for this particular presentation, I took that as a sign. A passage from Rabelais provides an initial metaphor. Have you ever seen a dog with a marrowsome bone? If you have, you have seen with what devotion he watches over it, with what care he guards it, with what fervor he holds it, with what prudence he gnaws it, with what affection he cracks it, and with what diligence he sucks upon it. And to what end? What does he expect from all of his pains and labor? Nothing more than a little marrow. The passage from Jonathan Swift provides another. Wisdom is a fox, which after long hunting will at last cost you the pains of digging it out. 'Tis a cheese, whereof to a discerning palate the maggots are the best. 'Tis a nut, which may cost you a tooth and give you nothing but a worm in return. The term magic is a difficult one to work with, but here is a common description. Magic refers to the use of words, ceremonies, charms, or spells to cause supernatural beings or powers to change something that happens in the natural world. To produce or prevent a particular result, such as rain or death or healing, one which cannot be brought about by natural means. Now, this is the essence of a standard dictionary definition, and is the one that Michael Quinn used in his 1987 book, Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. Magic includes the arts of divination, incantation, sympathetic magic affecting a person or a thing through its name or an object representing it, performance of miracles, control of natural forces by direct action of the right objects, materials, or words considered supernaturally potent. Now, it's in this sense that Quinn portrays Joseph Smith and the Smith family, along with a host of the founders of Mormonism, including Oliver Cowdery, Brigham Young, Wilford Woodruff, Heber C. Kimball, and Orson Pratt, as people who held a magical worldview, that is, one that believed magic to be possible, and who participated variously throughout their lives in such magical practices as use of divining rods, treasure digging, seer stones, amulets, astrology, magic parchments, talismans, and healing objects. Dissonance comes from the assertion that many early Mormons, including many of the founders, held this view, and the fact that most contemporary Mormons don't. To those who welcome such dissonance because it discomforts established Mormonism, the book is thus a cheese. To those whose faith in Mormonism is bound up in the picture of its origins, the book appears more like a nut. because, as Quinn himself recognizes, he recounts familiar events in an unfamiliar way and presents a story of Mormon origins that most Mormons would have difficulty in recognizing. What Quinn has done, I believe, is to show that if Joseph and Emma came back today dressed in clothes off the rack at Penny's and traveling incognito throughout the church as Bob and Marjorie Jones, and saying and doing ingenuously the things that Joseph said and did, he would sound, well, weird. The effect of Quinn's book is thus to lay bare the immense difference between Mormonism at its origins and in its present forms. He has insisted on the scandal of Mormonism, and that is scandalous. Hence, the book looks like a nut. On the other hand, Quinn himself deliberately and with good reason has set close limitations on his study. The book, he says, does not pretend to portray a full understanding of Western civilization, the Judeo-Christian tradition, early America, Joseph Smith and his family, Mormon origins, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or Latter-day Saints generally. Rather, he has chosen to focus on a narrow aspect, the perspective of magic as it relates to the worldview of early Mormons. He claims, then, to have done nothing more than open up the question for further study, scrutiny, and elaboration. Thus, the implications of the book are like the fox that remains yet to be dug out. And when we consider that we're at a time when the pace of change is accelerating in the larger society and within Mormonism, we see that Quinn has given us a chance to get a fix on where we have been and to try to discern where we're going. In a word, to try to understand the Mormon venture in a new time. Thus, the book begins to look distinctly like a bone. And I imagine that to those so inclined, the marrow that it might yield is substantial. The book has been widely and searchingly reviewed, and a number of reviewers have made the point, persuasively to my mind, that Quinn establishes the context of a magical worldview, and establishes that it might have been possible that Joseph and others participated in magical practices, but this is a widely held view among reviewers, it falls short of proving that they did, except in a few cases. Now, I can grant all of the reservations, critiques, and caveats of the reviewers, and there still remains a hard core of facts about magic and early Mormonism whose implications are yet to be drawn out. The question to be asked, really, is what kind of a worldview will enable or move someone to believe in magic? How does all of this relate to the totality of Joseph Smith? Was it a primary part or a secondary part? If the magical worldview described by Quinn gradually dissipated and passed away, as he says it did, what kind of worldview replaced it? What, in a word, is the significance of the magical worldview, and where does it lead? I believe then the time has come, at a distance of 4 years, to take another look at the magical worldview, and I have 3 points to make. The first is that the best procedure in this, as in all other knotty problems, is ever and always to try to see the problem in a wider context. And the wider context in this case consists of other worldviews, particularly 3 other worldviews which have been prominent in Western thought since antiquity. They are a theocentric worldview, a mechanistic worldview, and a homocentric worldview. The second point is that the phrase magical worldview standing alone may be misleading, since what has been called a magical worldview is really a subset. of a larger homocentric worldview. The third is that it was the homocentric worldview, not the magical worldview per se, that shaped Mormon doctrine, theology, and practice. The notion of worldview, or Weltanschauung, is even less easy to work with and yet more crucial than magic. We can get at the notion of worldview by comparing it with two other related terms, paradigm and culture. The term paradigm, as popularized 30 years ago by Thomas Kuhn as a means of describing scientific revolutions, is an implicit model established by a work so eminent such as Newton's Principia that it provides a set of assumptions for further research and determines what kinds of questions will be asked and what kinds of procedures will be used. Researchers will not question the suppositions until they encounter problems that it cannot solve, at which time there will be a paradigm shift. For example, physics was guided by the paradigm of Newton's work until the end of the 19th century, when it encountered problems that the Newtonian model could not solve, at which time it developed new suppositions in the form of quantum physics. The term culture refers to all the suppositions which people make to organize their society and its work. The rules of what is and is not permitted, how people relate to each other, what is valued and what is not. And the rules are usually inarticulated and invisible. We imbibe them from what we hear people talking about when we're children, from what we hear in classes, from tone of voice. We take them in with the air that we breathe, and we're not aware of them. We simply think, this is the way that real folks do it. Now, a worldview is on a level more general still, but like paradigm and culture, rests on a larger set of unspoken assumptions about how the cosmos is, what we may expect of the world, what humanity's place is in it, what is possible and what is impossible. We can go about digging out the assumption of a worldview by asking what is implied in a given document or ceremony about five aspects of people's expectations. First, what is ultimate in the cosmos? Is the cosmos personal or is it impersonal? Is it one or is it many? Second, how is humanity seen as relating to the cosmos? What is man's place in it? How shall we think about the possibility and nature of a future life? Three, how is the world known? On what can the mind rest? Four, what is the source and grounding of morality? Five, how should we think of evil? What forms does it take, and what are its origins and locus? We could also illustrate this by the story of the preacher who was talking about the creation of the world and said, the world rests on the back of a huge elephant. And someone from the congregation says, what is the elephant standing on? Well, the elephant is standing on the back of a huge turtle. Well, what is the turtle standing on? Well, the turtle is standing on a very large rock. What's the rock standing on? Don't ask questions, it's just rock all the way down. Now, each of us has a worldview, each of us has a place where we just say, it's rock all the way down. Worldviews are not impermeable. They change with age and experience, but we hold to them until our experience starts to overflow the categories that we've set up. In the meantime, these assumptions dictate what questions we'll ask and what we'll believe possible and impossible, what we expect from the world, and what we'll accept as evidence. Politically, for example, it was a major shift in consciousness when most of the population stopped believing in the divine right of kings and started believing in a social contract. But this change was prepared by an even more fundamental shift in views about God and the nature and place of man. The real revolutions are shifts in worldview and the attendant ways of thinking. Now, there are two difficulties in dealing with worldviews. First, since the worldview is pervasive and consists of a set of unspoken and initially unidentified assumptions, we have to dig below the surface in order to identify and describe them. Describing worldviews is essentially a process of identifying implications and presuppositions. Second, we form these assumptions unconsciously at an early age, and they in turn make up the basis of our private and communal logic. This logic seems seamless and preordained from the inside, but it always contains contradictions, inconsistencies, or inadequacies which appear obvious, even strange, bizarre, or weird to someone from the outside. Why will one culture, for example, leave its dead exposed on a high mountain as carrion, another embalm them, another cremate them, and another bury them in the earth in family burial plots? Simply because of the suppositions we make about the nature of the cosmos. A magical worldview is one which supposes magic to be possible. But to provide the context for that, I'd like to describe in broad outline first the theocentric and the mechanistic worldviews. Historically, theocentric views have been held among peoples who believe in a direct revelation, such as Islam, certain currents of Judaism, and certain currents of Christianity. Particularly the Augustinian current of Christianity, and when the reformers of the 16th and 17th century, Calvin and Luther outside the church and the Jansenists inside the church, undertook to purge the church of accumulated error, it was to St. Augustine that they looked for the source of pure doctrine. Now, what is prominent in the attention of someone who holds a theocentric view is the omnipotence, the awesomeness, the majesty of God. The world derives from creation and moves according to the will of God, who intervenes in its affairs and directs everything. Therefore, nothing is random. As an example from Islam, during the recent revolution, a mathematics professor was set to lecture on probability theory, and he held up a die as a visual aid. A fundamentalist Islamic student in the class cried out, "A satanic artifact!" And the teacher lost his job and almost his life. Why? Because there's no room for probability in a cosmos where God is constantly aware of all things past, present, and future, and is the cause of everything that is. Now, the world is known by revelation, which is also the grounding for morality. Certain actions are right because God has commanded them. Others are wrong because He has forbidden them. When people with a theocentric view theologize, they propose an objective and dogmatic theology, one which can assert unchanging truths and final understandings from which creeds can be drawn, which cast the last stone. They're able to theologize because the revelation is complete and definitive, and there won't be anything added to it. The world exists for God, and people are not, therefore, ends in themselves. They're dependent on the will of God, who has already decreed or else knows what their fate and future condition are. The proper stance of humankind is therefore one of obedience, acceptance, and humility. This kind of radical God-centeredness formed the basis of the new spirituality of the Reformation, with the Jansenist within the bosom of the Church. For Luther, the Renaissance idea of an almost godlike status of humanity perverted the true Christian doctrine. In reality, we can appear before God only as beggars. And his last words were reported to have been, "We are all beggars, that is true." Calvin held a similar view. The true Christian life must be entirely focused on the divine. "There is no part of our life," he wrote, "and no action so minute that it ought not to be directed to the glory of God. Nothing worse can happen to a human being than not to live for God." Now, heaven for both of these reformers was likewise God-centered and consisted of the contemplation of the essence of God. In seeing God, the blessed are passive while God is fully active. But even in his heaven, God maintains his distance, says Calvin, "and our glory will not be so perfect as to allow our vision to comprehend the Lord completely. There will always be a wide distance between him and ourselves." Reformation theology held that humans could never invade heaven, approach God as a friend, and expect any degree of intimacy. Luther and Calvin both expected the family unit would not survive death, for in their mind, marriage implied rule and rank. In heaven, everyone would be equal, and all of the divisions which partake of the earth, that is, husband, wife, parent, children, as superior, inferior, would all be wiped out. When we ask about the presence of evil in the world, the proponents of theocentrism are hard-pressed, yet the staunchest of them did not shrink. For Calvin, it really was God who hardened Pharaoh's heart. And they took literally the words in Isaiah, "I am the Lord, there is none else. I make peace and I create evil." And for these reasons, the devil has been an embarrassment in theocentric systems whenever they've been pushed to their logical conclusions, which the 17th century Dutch theologian Balthasar Bekker took as his task. In a four-volume work published in Amsterdam in 1692 and translated as The World Bewitched, he undertook to show that all of the power popularly attributed to the devil was incompatible with the sovereignty of God and came from false pagans that had found their way into Christianity through corrupt papist practices. And it was the work of the Reformed to purge them out. Unregenerate humanity was in itself a rich enough source of evil without infringing upon God's sovereignty by compromising it and yielding it to the devil. Although theocentrism has not disappeared from Christianity, and 800 million Muslims profess it worldwide, the worldview that is the basis of modern science and that has become dominant in Europe and the United States in the past 250 years is mechanistic. It likewise goes far back into antiquity, starting with Democritus. We see it in Epicurus and Lucretius around the time of Christ, revived again in the Renaissance. It becomes dominant in the 18th century and furnishes the suppositions upon which science is founded. The biological sciences of Darwin, the social doctrines of Marx, and the psychological doctrines of Freud are all based upon mechanistic principles. When we look at the world from a mechanistic perspective, we see a great machine, and the world looks and acts like a great machine. We know the world by experience and experimentation. Knowledge is objective, and therefore science is possible. The foundation of the mechanistic view is the supposition that nature is everywhere the same in all of its parts, and that nature is inert, whereas human beings are ert. And therefore are capable of manipulating nature, and in the phrase of Descartes, to become the masters and the possessors of nature. In the mechanistic worldview, the cosmos is ultimately impersonal. There's nobody out there. And the question of heaven is moot, since the human personality does not survive death. Humans are not recyclable. They're only biodegradable. The world is known by experience and experimentation, and morality is founded on custom or habit, as in Hume, or in the exercise of human reason, as in Kant or Plato. The mechanistic view has yielded optimism as it has emphasized human reason, and with the 18th century view of unlimited progress in store for the human race, or Bernard Baruch's statement that all human problems are caused by humans and can be solved by humans. It has yielded pessimism, deep pessimism, when absorbing the belief that the universe is devoid of personality and does not move with intentionality toward us. The universe does not care. Speaking from this point of view, the French anthropologist Lévi-Strauss said, "The world began without man and will end without him. The institutions, mores, and customs that I've spent my life inventorying and understanding are a passing efflorescence in a creation in relation to which they have no meaning except that they allow humanity to play its role. The role of man does not give him a privileged position or independent place in the scheme of things. Nor does it impose upon him the duty of opposing or struggling against the general disintegration. Humanity also looks like a great machine within a machine, contributing to the general movement toward inertia." Now, within the mechanistic view, evil is as great a puzzle as it is for theocentrism. It's not against the nature of things that some species should flux in and others flux out, that big fish should eat little fish should eat shrimp, and shrimp eat mud, or that the strong should survive and the weak perish, but that the destruction should be wanton, should be intentional in a universe which is otherwise intentionless, or, on the other hand, that some people should choose to suffer injustices rather than commit them, is the supreme example of strangeness of human beings. Now, neither theocentrism or mechanism allows for the possibility of magic. To get magic, you have to make other suppositions about the world, as in the homocentric tradition, which, like the others, goes back to antiquity. We find examples in ancient Egypt. We find them in the Christian Gnostics, in the medieval alchemists. The scientists of the Renaissance were also magicians. We find it in Paracelsus, the founder of modern medicine, reputedly. Swedenborg in the 18th century, in Goethe, and in the 20th century, we find the current stemming from the Swiss psychologist Carl Jung. Now, at the basis of the homocentric view is the notion that man is a microcosm. To illustrate, we might ask, with regard to the Christmas story, what made the wise men wise? There must have been 10,000 people who noticed an especially bright star in the sky. How come only three of them showed up in Jerusalem and not 10,000? Well, the wise men were wise because they had studied the stars. And in the stars are configured all of the events of this planet and the human race. If they had been just astronomers, they would have been content to describe the paths of the stars. But they were astrologers. And therefore, they inquired into the hidden connections between the stars and human events. The Earth is thus a microcosm of the heavens, and not only the Earth, but every individual is a microcosm, is the universe writ small, or the universe is each individual writ large. Said Swedenborg, we are not enough aware that the world is the great man, as contrasted with the great machine. On our refractory planet will be fulfilled the purpose of the universe, which is a great machine for the making of gods. Someone with this view will look at human beings and look at the world and see it as a place of contest, a place where humans are free. Luther said, humanity is a donkey, and either God or the devil is in the saddle. But if we have a homocentric view, we are impressed with the capabilities and the innate powers of people and the idea that they are morally capable. All people are capable of all things. And where do evil and the devil fit in the human homocentric view? Evil is the stuff out of which human growth occurs. In Goethe's Faust asks Mephistopheles at one point, who are you anyway? Mephistopheles answers, I am that spirit never understood that always wills the bad but always works the good. And on another occasion, Goethe said, the world is a great organ upon which God plays while the devil pumps the bellows. Now, it is important to insist on one other aspect of this view. That is that the universe is numinous. That is, it's alive. There's something out there wiggling. The universe, nature, is charged with a vital energies, living powers that we can enter into contact with, and the way that we fulfill our human destiny is by entering into cooperation with them. Paracelsus said that nothing, nature gives nothing to man in a finished state, not even himself. And it is up to man to be the creator through interaction with what he discovers in nature. Now, let's come to the question of magic. When we talk about magic, we're not talking about sleight of hand tricks, and we're not talking about superstition and misattribution of cause. But we've seen a kind of high magic that attempts to see into the workings of nature to see the future. In this one aspect, it closely resembles science. But in the definition used by Quinn in modern dictionaries, it involves the attempt to get control of the forces of the unseen, and by aid of invisible and supernatural beings to control the course of nature. Now, what is witchcraft? Witchcraft is a form of magic, and witchcraft involved the making of a pact with the devil. No devil, no witchcraft. And the devil, in turn, delegated powers to those who chose to be of his church, and It was part of the tradition that the devil had a church. And this is how witches caused the neighbor's crop to fail, or caused hail to fall upon his fruit trees, or his animals to abort their young. You can only get magic under a homocentric view. In the homocentric view, there's the widest range of possibility for human beings. They can become diabolical, incarnating evil. They can become as gods. On the other two views, they're in a very limited, narrow range. Now, this gives us the possibility of making a distinction between religion and magic. The root meaning of religion is that which binds together. We can call religious the change that symbols work within agents to bring them into a cooperating relationship with God, where an example cited by a Jungian is the Navajo sand painting. Person falls sick, goes to consult the medicine man, who begins to do a sand painting. If we have an unobserved practicing positivist in the corner, he looks at the ceremony and he says, the medicine man is trying to get the sand painting to work on the symptoms directly, and that is magic. Actually, seen from the inside, what the medicine man is doing, what the sand painting is doing, is getting the individual reestablished in the harmony of the larger scheme, and nature will do the healing. A shot of penicillin, which would relieve the symptoms but leave the individual in the inner life, would not be religious. The sand painting, on the other hand, if it changes and restores the individual to harmony with the larger order, would be religious. Now that seems to me the key, because the essence of the homocentric view is that we are never in a finished state. We are always becoming something else. We are not human beings, we are human becomings. Now, in that sense, is there magic in the Book of Mormon? Well, we find no Ouija boards, no crystal balls, no, oops. What was this ball that Lehi found outside of his tent? Why, it was a curious ball, not crystal, but of brass. Then it functioned like a compass to show directions which way they should go, but it was not an ordinary compass. It worked only according to faith. Now, a wicked man, or a cynical woman, or a corrupt boy, or a loose lass, can all work a compass, because it works on mechanical principles. Could they work the Liahona? No. First, a change has to come within the individual, and then there is a corresponding change in the natural world of which we are a part. The same can be said about the plates that King Limhi found and the translation of them, not by someone who knew languages, but by the capacity of the seer, a gift of God to see into hidden things. Now, given this distinction, is there still magic in the Book of Mormon? Yes, there is. But in every place where it is found, it is condemned as an example of wickedness. I'm going to have to move on. I'll just mention sorceries, witchcraft, soothsaying, magics that are mentioned and condemned as wickedness. Now, we can also find an example of this kind of difference between magic and religion in the journals of William Clayton, as he describes the attitude toward the newly instituted endowment ceremony. And quoting George A. Smith in a meeting in the Nauvoo Temple, he says, that when we have the endowment, we have the true order of prayer, we can prepare ourselves adequately. It's a principle of unity, and our prayers, therefore, are answered. Now, in the same meeting, George Miller testifies to the endowment by saying that his life was spared because he was wearing his garment. He was shot at and missed, and the sentinel next to him was killed. Heber C. Kimball, in the same meeting, goes one better, and he says, well, just look at Carthage. Willard Richards was wearing his robe, as they called it, and he was not injured, but John Taylor, Joseph, and Hiram were not wearing their garments, and they were shot to pieces. Well, John Taylor was in the audience. He said, yes, that's true. We're not wearing our robes. But Joseph had laid his aside because of the hot weather. Now, it was interesting to me that at that point it appeared that the attitudes of people were seeing this same phenomenon in two different ways. One, there's an inner change that is wrought by the practice, and that is what constitutes the religious part. There is another attitude which says the thing itself causes the event in the world, and it seems to me that would be an example of magic. Now, maybe the major point that I'm working up to, we have to come to a homocentric view in order to see the source of Mormon teachings and theology. We can mention just a few of them. We see how far Mormonism departs from the theocentric sovereignty of God in Moses 1 and 39. This is my work and my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and the eternal life of man. People are at the center of it. Another place in the Doctrine and Covenants, he says, "Behold, I call you my friends. We are of the same family." Another purpose of mortality is to be put to the test. And we have the power within us to bring to pass much good and righteousness. It's not only to see how we will respond to what we are commanded to do, but to see what we will do on our own. Now, some of the implications that I see in all of this for theology is, first of all, that we cannot do theology, at least in a dogmatic sense. We have to do theology in one sense, that is to make sense out of the religious experience that exceeds our rational dimension. And we have to have theology in that sense as a street sweeper that comes to tidy up after the elephant parade. We cannot do dogmatic theology and ever say that we have an unimprovable understanding of anything whatsoever. Because the center of the thing is elsewhere. The center of the thing is what is going on inside of the individual as we work in contact and cooperation with the living forces in the cosmos. That is the scandal of Mormonism. It's the real scandal, and I say, let the scandal thrive. There's some more conclusions here that I was going to read, and if we have a minute, we might, but I'd like to give the time right now to Brother Tobler.
Thank you, Paul. I'm happy to be here today. I was especially happy to come to meet the Sandbergs. I had not met them before except through garbled facts. And I knew that couldn't be true. But he had, in fact, sent me an earlier copy of the paper. Wasn't finished, but so I pieced part of it together that way. But I had known about them through their daughter, Shireen, who had been with us on the study abroad program in Vienna in 1984. And she was a magnificent person, total person. And so I wasn't surprised when I got to know the parents. I appreciate the opportunity to read and comment on this very stimulating and incredibly thought-provoking paper. Quinn and Sandberg have both done our understanding of Mormonism, I believe, a service in seeing Mormonism as indeed a Weltanschauung, or at least a part of one, or worldview. And I think this is a service for several reasons. It seems to me it's especially important for intellectuals, both in and out of the church and around the globe, but particularly outside of America, to see Mormonism as something of a comprehensive alternate worldview and not just as a sectarian aberration. In societies different from our own, where, quote, the conventional wisdom is more heavily determined by intellectuals, this may allow Mormonism what it has missed seriously up to this time, and that is to be taken seriously as an intellectual system, as a worldview. Also, I think that that this offers the idea that Joseph Smith is giving an alternative Christian worldview, which underscores in my mind the comprehensiveness and profundity of his thought. I now want to comment on three ideas in the early part, or four, in the early part of the paper, before dealing with what seems to me to be the fundamental thesis. First of all, I agree with Carl that the revolution in thought and in worldview is indeed the real revolution. And that these assumptions, these that are below the surface, these very fundamental ways in which we view the world are absolutely crucial. This is a little plug for intellectual history, as helping us to get at this reality. A second point, I am not so certain that there really is a great dissonance, particularly in Weltanschauung, between early and later Mormons, Joseph and Joseph and Emma and Marjorie Jones. I am not persuaded that magic is a major or even significant part of whatever dissonance there is. I've often wondered if historians and others do not overstate change at the expense of continuity in these matters. Franklin Balmer, in a book that I cherish called Modern European Thought, Continuity and Change in Ideas, 1600 and 1950, discusses this phenomenon in great detail and, I think, with great persuasiveness, where he lauds a healthy tension between the two as the best climate overall for the stimulation of ideas. One of the strengths of Mormonism, therefore, in my view, is the nature of the mix between continuity and change, between being and becoming, that it offers. Third point. I believe that I agree with both Quinn and Sandberg that there was a context of magic surrounding Joseph and his friends, and that they participated in it. I also agree with Sandberg that Quinn's book falls short in providing convincing evidence of a causal relationship between magic and Mormonism. What is documented strikes me as more fascination and proximity than causality. The magical context, moreover, recedes into the background as experience, revelation, spirituality, and wisdom increase. A fourth point, just in a general sense. I believe that the passing away of the magical worldview, which both of them have described, out of Mormonism, at whatever level of significance or insignificance, has left the church and its Weltanschauung, its worldview, intact and viable. Leaving the church and its Weltanschauung intact and viable says something about how integral or even meaningful it was as a formative force or agent in the formation and content of Mormonism. Those sort of preliminary observations. Now, one of the problems that I have with this essay has to do with the definition of the key words. And I will cite three of them. There are others. The first is the term Weltanschauung, or worldview itself. To me, the term worldview is very comprehensive and includes within it all of the things that Frank Baumer describes as the big or perennial questions and answers which human beings have considered since the beginning and which seem to be fundamental to being human. These are questions which we ask and for which we seek answers now precisely as part of our humanness and maybe even part of our divinity, I'm not sure. These include the questions about God. Carl has referred to some of these in a different way. Does he exist? How do we know he exists? What attributes does he have? Does he relate? How does he relate to man? The questions about nature. What is physical nature made of? By what principles does it operate? There are many others connected with this. The question of humankind. Do we have a fixed nature? Is freedom a chief characteristic of that nature, for example? Society, what is its nature? Is it static or dynamic? What is its relationship to the individual? What about history? What about ethics? What about epistemology? How do we know what we know? I think I prefer a definition that underscores what seems to me greater comprehensiveness and totality, like this one from the Harper's Dictionary of Modern Thought. Worldview, Weltanschauung, is, quote, a general conception of the nature of the world, particularly as containing or implying a system of value principles. Any total philosophical system may be so styled which derives practical consequences from its theoretical components. Strikes me that last part is particularly interesting. Like Sandburg, magic does not strike me as being anywhere near comprehensive enough to be called a worldview. Whether it can best be understood as a component of a homocentric, as a subset of a homocentric worldview, depends largely on what definition that you use, but I find it difficult to accept that. Now, a second, besides the definition of Weltanschauung, there's a question of the definition of a theocentric worldview. Sandburg's definition, with its emphasis on the Calvinistic notion of the absolute sovereignty, omnipotence, and majesty of God, and of divine determinism, strikes me as arbitrarily narrow and rigid, and I wonder if this is correct. It certainly can be defined and interpreted in that way, but I don't think it needs to be. And I don't think historically the notion of theocentrism has been defined in this way. I am not persuaded, for example, that either Judaism or Christianity is best characterized by this definition. I don't know enough about Islam to make any kind of comment, although it does seem that those folks are a little rigid. Both St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas wrestled with this question. And also the question of human free will. I am not persuaded that either of them in their theology or practice was as rigidly committed to the notion of divine determinism as what we have been led to believe. There is a good bit of evidence that Augustine and certainly Aquinas found room, some considerable room for free will in their systems, in their theocentric systems. The same is equally, if not more true, for Luther. Luther's quintessential work is called The Freedom of a Christian, and it contains this thesis statement. A Christian is a perfectly free lord of all, subject to none. So here again, the question, I would like to introduce some elasticity into the notions of the theocentric Weltanschauung. Moreover, both Luther and Calvin looked more to the Bible than to St. Augustine in their thought. A more realistic and comprehensive definition of the theocentric worldview is not one that excludes human free will, but sees God alive and well in general charge of the world and the universe, interacting with human beings and nature, and as Sandburg rightly emphasizes, deeply caring for his children. I want to conclude this then by saying that a God-centered worldview does not necessarily require, it seems to me, a completely God-dominated cosmos. I will not linger long on the mechanistic worldview because, in general, I agree with Sandburg's analysis of it. I would only add that historically, the power of the mechanistic worldview has both diminished theocentrism and imbued the intellectual world with a set of assumptions inimical to metaphysics and all kinds of views with metaphysical elements. We may only now be seeing movements in the world to reconsider, in a serious way, religious worldview. Sandburg's definition of the homocentric worldview is, conversely, to my way of thinking, very broad and elastic. I have not previously thought of magic and astrology as part of it, rather as something that belonged to the worlds of spirit, maybe even part of this expanded theocentric worldview that I've just tried to describe. What I do resonate with, and perhaps this helps make his point of the non-magical in modern Mormons, is a definition of homocentric that is, as he writes, more aware of the innate powers and capabilities of human beings, and therefore believes more in human liberty. I find it difficult to agree with Sandburg or Quinn also in the use of the term occult to characterize the sense in which the truth of human existence, quote, the truth of human existence is hidden. There is indeed a great deal about human existence that is mysterious, that we do not know. But as I understand Mormonism, this truth is revealed through a combination of human will, human mind, human asking, and divine grace and dispensation. It is true that a homocentric view undergirds the elaboration of Mormon doctrine of deity, but what strikes me as more important is the way in which elements of the theocentric and homocentric worldviews come together to provide now the source of Mormonism. I am not persuaded, quote, that the worldview that held magic possible, the homocentric view, was very large, even pervading every aspect of that which is essentially Mormon, or that, quote, the homocentric worldview provides the distinctive and basic pieces of Mormon. For me, this is claiming too much. Finally, I believe I agree with Sandburg that the real scandal of Mormonism is indeed that we, quote, believe in the reality of the interaction between humans and beings and forces from the invisible world, but I disagree that these are necessarily from the magical or occult side. Rather, it is the continued belief in the living and active divine, which together with human free will best helps us to understand Mormonism and helps us to see the magical, from my point of view, insignificant as it was in the formation of the Mormon worldview, has disappeared from the scene. And as a last point, in conclusion, I'm not at all certain that I can see Mormonism as heavily influenced, if not determined, by the homocentric worldview, or that this really advances fully or advances our understanding of Mormonism, its claims, and its achievements. Thank you.
I'd like to thank our panelists. In the interest of time and the tape, I'd like to limit questions from the audience to three and direct it to the panelists. Could the panelists please repeat the question for the microphone? Are there any questions?